Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, September 5, 2013. The scene, St. Petersburg, Russia, where Obama and Putin smile for the paparazzi.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend.
But not for long.
Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within. Smiling faces sometimes they don't tell the truth.
The New York Times reports that Putin greeted Obama with equally businesslike cordiality, and the two turned the assembled journalists to pose momentarily with broad, camera-ready smiles. Neither grabbed the other's arm or patted a back, as they often do with fellow leaders. It was protocol, it was proper, but it was not warm. And not all of this can be blamed on Vladimir Putin. I don't think much of the guy. He is an apparatchik who came out of the KGB. He is an iron-fisted ruler of Russia. And I have no brief for Vlad. But before the trip, Obama, of course, snubbed him over the Ed Snowden asylum case. We'll get to some interesting details about that in just a second. And also some gratuitous comments. In August, Obama noted Putin's slouch, said he gave the appearance of a bored kid in school. Now, I've seen that, and that's a fair comment. It's just not very diplomatic. And the chilly relations between the U.S. and Russia, of course, really take shape around the issues of Syria. So here's Obama avoiding Putin and working some but not all of the leaders at the G20 summit in St. Petersburg. The article here says, beyond France, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, Obama may find few who will vocally back a limited strike against the government in Syria. He didn't even talk to David Cameron of Britain, or at least schedule a one-on-one with him, after Cameron put himself on the line and lost a vote in Parliament last week over Obama's desire to shore up his credibility by striking in Syria. And against that backdrop, just before Obama arrived, Putin gave an interview, and the LA Times picked up the story from the AP and from the First Channel in Russia. And it turns out that Ed Snowden was in touch with the Russians before he left Hong Kong. That's news to me. Putin let this cat out of the bag in the televised interview. Quote, I was informed that there was such an agent of special services. I asked them, what does he want? Putin said. He is fighting for human rights, for free spreading of information. And I said, so what? This is classic Putin. If he wants to stay in Russia, he is welcome and he can stay. But in this case, he must stop all activities which could destroy Russian-U.S. relations. Now, this is rich. Because U.S.-Russian relations are already on ice. And the idea that Putin wants to improve them by shutting down Ed Snowden, I find that amusing. And Putin went on, no, we won't struggle together with him, I said. Let him struggle by himself. Then he went away. He simply went away, that's all. Then he began his flight to Latin America. He said that was compounded by the U.S. cancellation of Snowden's passport. And one more quote from Putin. The problem is not that we're defending Snowden, we're not protecting him at all. The problem is we don't have an agreement with the United States on the mutual handing over of criminals. And Russia has proposed such an agreement in the past, but those proposals have been rejected by the United States. My friend and colleague Sibel Edmonds, the publisher of Boiling Frogs Post, has a hot one posted today. And she argues that the U.S. has been looking for a bone to throw to the Russians to get Russia to at least go neutral at the Security Council of the UN and allow for some international operation against Syria. Sabel reveals and argues that that bone may be the U.S. fingering Georgia, not where Atlanta is, no, Georgia, the former Soviet Republic, for training Chechen fighters, those who fight against the government of Moscow, and those who are fighting in Syria today. Take a look at BoilingFrogsPost.com and follow that, because Sabel has a lot of great sources in that part of the world, and I think an instinct that many of us Americans will never develop. Meanwhile, Putin has ordered warships into the eastern Mediterranean near Syria. Three Russian warships crossed the Bosphorus today near Istanbul en route to the Syrian coast. They are the SSV-201 intelligence ship Pryazovya, accompanied by two landing ships, Minsk and Novosherkask. And they went through the straits there in Istanbul on their way to line up with the American fleets in the same area. More news and comment, including John Kerry's blockbuster about Arabs offering to pay for America's military adventure. But first, I want to thank the people who support this program with your subscriptions, like Anna Marie Taylor, Tom Burkhardt, all the way over in Europe, Miko Silvanoinen. And Miko, your package of swag is on the way. And let's not forget Faith Peoples. They all subscribe, and you can do it too. Just go to my website, peterbcollins.com, follow the links under my picture that say sign up. You can choose $1 for a 24-hour pass, $5 a month, cancel anytime. $50 a year is the best deal. And I still have Kona coffee from Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii to send as your thank you for subscribing. And a few copies remain of Sabel Edmonds' Classified Woman. It's a great book and more important than ever. So do me a favor and take out a subscription today. Help support this work, and you will have my gratitude. The other way you can help us is by doing your business with GoDaddy.com. Take out a domain name or set up a web hosting account. They have such a screaming deal for $1.99 a month. You get web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, and they will throw in your domain name free. And they have exceptional customer service, I know, because I have been a customer of GoDaddy's for more than 10 years. And for a special deal that supports the PBC show, follow the GoDaddy link in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Credit to Mark Carlin, the BuzzFlash editor who merged with Truth Out about a year ago. He caught comments from John Kerry at Wednesday's hearing on Capitol Hill. Asked by a congresswoman from Florida if Arab countries might pay for the cost of a military assault on Syria, John Kerry said, with respect to Arab countries offering to bear costs and to assess, the answer is profoundly yes, they have. That offer is on the table. Now, he didn't name the Arab governments, the Arab countries. They're most likely Saudi Arabia and the Emirate of Qatar. They have already invested heavily using mercenaries in the war in Syria. And if they can pay the United States to do their dirty work, that would make us mercenaries as well, wouldn't it? Now, Poppy Bush, George H.W. Bush, got a free ride on the first Gulf War because the oil emirs in Kuwait paid most of the tab for Desert Storm. And that was seen as a good thing at the time. We were able to have a heroic liberation of Kuwait, and American taxpayers didn't have to foot the bill. And Mark Carlin at BuzzFlash also raised some interesting questions about an exchange between John Kerry and a Republican congressman from Texas, Michael McCaul. And the issue there is the rebels, the opposition to the Assad government, or it's called a regime when we don't like the government. I find that a very loaded term. But interestingly, in the exchange, McCaul said that he thinks that at least half of the so-called rebels are extremists. and that there is no real moderate opposition that exists there. John Kerry, without offering any evidence, and of course he does have access to all of our secret intelligence, he said that there are about 70 to 100,000 oppositionists. Sound like an enemy combatant, one of these new concocted terms? And of these, he said maybe 15 or 20% are bad guys. That's a technical term, you know. McCall said that he'd been told in briefings that half of the opposition fighters are extremists. Now, I don't pretend to know what the proportion there is. But based on all of the information that I've gathered from ordinary sources and outside sources and offshore outlets, all I can say is the idea, and I discussed this the other day, that Carl Levin, the senator from Michigan, thinks that we can provide arms and other military support to what he called vetted moderates in Syria. And even if such a group exists, and I'm dubious, how do we keep them from losing control of weapons or voluntarily passing them to more aggressive, more extreme jihadists? Now, it's also being reported in today's New York Times that the Syrian rebels brutally shoot prisoners of war, whom they capture from the Syrian army, and that some of the fighting that's going on is about turf. It's not just about bringing down the Assad government. It's jockeying for control of regions of Syria. And that's going to make it even more difficult in a presumed post-Assad world to sort out who can be trusted and who we can deal with. And it just points up once again that the idea that we can control all this, that we can launch limited targeted strikes and will remain in control, is just bizarre. No one can make those assurances. No one knows. It's entirely possible we could strike Syria and there would be no repercussions. I find that far-fetched. I got a dispatch from Alan Grayson, the fiery Democratic congressman from Florida, who is kind of unofficially leading the liberal Democrats to vote against Obama's adventure in Syria. And he cites a number of polls out there. ABC News has the one that shows almost 200 members of the House are ready to vote no on the authorization to strike Syria, and only 45 members so far have said they're flatly for it or they lean that way. The Washington Post has slightly different numbers, 178 against, only 19 for. Fire Dog Lake, they've got a poll, 144 members against, 58. 28 firmly yes, 30 leaning yes. And The Hill, one more poll for you. 89 members against military intervention, only 28 in favor. Now, here in the Bay Area, we have a very unusual situation. Nancy Pelosi, longtime Democrat in the House and the leader, the minority leader in the House of Representatives, has closed ranks with the president. She claims that since little children were killed, that this is in the national interest of the United States to strike Syria. I respectfully disagree with Nancy on this, as you might guess. And what's interesting is that only one member of the all-Democratic Bay Area congressional delegation, a freshman named Eric Swalwell from the East Bay, has flatly said he will vote for this mess. Let's run through them. Jared Huffman, my congressman here, north of the Golden Gate Bridge, he's leaning no. He said, so far we've basically been presented with only two choices, support immediate unilateral action by the U.S. without a clear sense of where it takes us and the region, or you do nothing and be accused of acquiescing in the use of chemical weapons. Jared, that is right on. This is a set of false choices being presented. And I keep arguing that if we really want to make a statement about the vulnerability of innocent women, children, civilians in Syria, to chemical weapons. Sending cruise missiles will not send any message that has meaning. You can't bully a bully. But if we drop gas masks and protective chemical suits all over Syria, I think that would send a very powerful message. Zoe Lofgren, who is on the Judiciary Committee in the House, she is wary but still examining. Anna Eshoo from Silicon Valley describes herself as dubious. My pal John Garamendi, who's in his first full term as a member of Congress, or maybe it's his second now. Yeah, it is. It's his second. He gave five reasons for voting no. There's not even a 50-50 chance that this will stop Assad from doing another chemical attack if he feels his government is threatened with extinction. There is no assurance that chemical weapons would not get in the hands of the other bad guys after a U.S. attack, especially if Assad is weakened further. My local paper didn't allow room for his other three reasons to vote against it. George Miller's in a pickle. He's a great guy, a very liberal guy, but he is a lieutenant in the hierarchy of Nancy Pelosi. And so he is currently undecided. Mike Honda, San Jose, is leaning no. Barbara Lee is hell no. Great leader from Oakland. Mike Thompson, straddling the fence. He's from Napa and Sonoma and sits on the Intelligence Committee and is the subject of protests over his vote against the Amash Amendment a few weeks back that would have zeroed out funding for the NSA collection of our phone records. The one member who was not available for this recap is Jackie Speier, the Democrat from the San Francisco Peninsula. I want to recommend an article by Gareth Porter, and I'll put up a link to it in the show file with this podcast. He published on September 3rd at Truth Out, How Intelligence Was Twisted to Support an Attack on Syria. And Gareth is a great reporter who always digs deep. And he's come up with some very interesting information about how the Obama Kerry team first demanded that UN inspectors be allowed into Syria, and then when they got there, hustled them out just as fast as they could. There's also a fascinating unpacking of the claim that's unproven that intercepted communications prove that the Syrians authorized the use of chemical weapons. There's also, we also discuss a report that was recently published that says the U.S. knew 3 days ahead of August 21st that chemical weapons were being prepared, and yet we warned no one. My conversation with Gareth Porter is available over at Boiling Frog's Post right now. We have a new series that I'm hosting called Processing Distortion. And you can hear that interview at Boiling Frog's Post. Here's an excerpt where Gareth Porter talks about Susan Rice and the people in the Obama administration who are tagged as cruise missile liberals.
A friend of mine, a journalist friend, who was talking to a military source who called Susan Rice not a limousine liberal, but a cruise missile liberal, and so the cruise missile liberals now of the Obama administration are really so eager to carry out a strike that you know they were in a hurry certainly to carry out a strike, and they did not want any information coming out of a UN investigation that could complicate things, whether it was to say that we can't be sure that it was a chemical weapon strike or a nerve agent, or that it wasn't. Either one of those would have been a very problematic situation for them. So they were clearly deliberately trying to torpedo. They put pressure on the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, to try to get him to call off, to withdraw the UN investigators from Damascus, which is really quite a brazen thing to do. And Ban Ki-moon, who is widely known to be, you know, a very pliable person for as far as the United States policy is concerned, he's always been very willing to do the bidding of the United States, apparently had some stiffening of his spine, and he said, no, I'm not going to call them off. I think he felt that was an insult to the United Nations, and of course it's true that it was.
My full interview with Gareth Porter is available today at boilingfrogspost.com. Well, the New York Times has been skunked by The Guardian in Britain, by The Washington Post to some extent, and a few other outlets that receive the treasure trove of information leaked by Ed Snowden. So today, in a lengthy investigative report, the New York Times exposes how the NSA has been able to hack encryption, or digital scrambling. It appears that they can hack or crack almost any encryption system and have successfully done so. And while the spooks may be very proud of that work, there's a downside to this. And that is that these hacks usually involve what's called a backdoor. And one of the ways the NSA beats encryption is by getting a hold of a computer where a message is being created before that message is encrypted. That's one of the things, one of the really big things that Ed Snowden revealed. They have the capability of watching your screen as you write a memo or type an email. So that's one way they get around the encryption issue. But by installing these backdoors, they make it possible for other hackers to crack in. And this all came about in the 1990s after the NSA lost the debate over the official backdoor called the Clipper chip. And Matthew Green, a cryptography researcher at Johns Hopkins, is quoted, "The risk is that when you build a backdoor into systems, you're not the only one to exploit it. Those backdoors could work against U.S. communications, too." And the level of cracking of encryption has reached such an extent that when members of the Government Communications Headquarters in Britain, or GCHQ, were briefed on this, quote, cryptanalytic capabilities are now coming online. Vast amounts of encrypted internet data, which have up till now been discarded, are now exploitable. When the British analysts, who often work side by side with NSA officers, were first told about the program, another memo said those not already briefed were gobsmacked. Well, I guess gobsmacking is what spies get really excited about. There's a new pope in the Vatican, and he is no longer, like his predecessor, turning a blind eye to accusations of pedophilia. The Vatican has recalled the, essentially, ambassador, he's called the papal nuncio, to the Dominican Republic. He's been accused of pedophilia. We don't have any details on the alleged sex crimes, but the pope has announced that Archbishop Joseph Wesolowski has been recalled to the Vatican. And while I don't know the extent of this, this is now the second case where the new Pope Francis has basically said, I don't care if you're a bishop or cardinal, no one is above the moral standards, not only legal standards, of the Roman Catholic Church. That's refreshing. Here in California, the 60-day prison hunger strike has ended after a rare meeting among inmates who have often spent years, in some cases decades, in isolation. State prison officials permitted four leaders of the hunger strike to gather at the law library at the Pelican Bay State Prison. That's where the so-called SHU, the Security Housing Unit, is. It's one of them in the California system. Prison officials allowed them to meet, and also 14 of their organizers were gathered, representing four main ethnic and racial groups in the California prisons. They even let them make phone calls to strike leaders at other institutions in the state. And at the end of it, while the prisoners got just a few concessions from the Department of Corrections, they decided to end their strike. And so that one is behind us. And unfortunately, Governor Jerry Brown, the former seminarian, doesn't seem to really understand the humanity of all this. And he is continuing his battle with the leader of the state Senate, Daryl Steinberg. Brown wants to spend over the next 2 years over $700 million to rent cells in private prisons, some in California, some in other states. Because a federal court has ordered California to reduce its population because the overpopulation is killing people. And Jerry Brown is so defiant that I feel like someone has occupied his body. As I've mentioned, he has been posturing because he doesn't want a Willie Horton blamed on him. But in this battle with the leader of the state Senate, Brown has gone too far. He says the plan approved by the Senate Budget Committee is an inmate release plan by another name, totally dependent on an illusory legal settlement. I will not turn over our criminal justice system to lawyers who operate at the behest of their inmate clients, and not the people, whose interests we are sworn to uphold. Moreover, the plan adds huge burdens to local government, which threaten to undo the remarkable progress we've made in realignment. That's where he took prisoners from state institutions and sent them to county jails to serve their time. And I know quite well that Brown could meet the targets that the federal courts have set for reducing the prison population. It's just under 10,000. By releasing life prisoners over the age of 70, who pose almost zero threat of reoffending. And finally today, this is the first time I have ever commented on the grisly crimes and case of Ariel Castro. He's the guy from Cleveland who had three women imprisoned in his house. And while the national media went bonkers over this case into full tabloid overdrive, I never brought it up because I don't consider it that much of a national story. Ariel Castro was one of the lowest life forms that we can imagine trotting this earth. And there is simply no defense for what he did. Now we are told that he hanged himself and died at the Correctional Reception Center in Orient, south of the capital city of Columbus, in central Ohio. They say that he hung himself, that he was under a watch, but not a suicide watch, and that he successfully took his life. And that may all be completely true. But we have a long and sordid history in this country that when sex offenders go to prison, the guards turn their heads and prisoners attack the sex offenders. And while many people, and I saw these smug, gloating comments that people put up on Facebook when they got the news that Ariel Castro had killed himself. And frankly, I find that really almost as disgusting as what he did. Because people who have no connection to his case whatsoever feel empowered to judge him. And I believe that prisons have an obligation to protect the inmates from wayward prisoners and from wayward guards. And I have not a shred of evidence here that his death is anything other than the suicide that has been reported. But given the history that I just described, I'd like to see a real investigation. I'd like to know if guards enabled Ariel Castro to kill himself. I'd like to know if the suicide story is actually a cover for an assault by another prisoner. It's possible. And I think we deserve to know, especially since this was a story kind of foisted on us as one of national importance, when really it was just an ugly case of sex and violence that could be exploited by our for-profit media in this country. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. Your comments for me are welcome. Peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until